because we care. We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dads on the air. We're back with Dads on the Air.
Well, all the best to all our listeners for 2010. What a spectacular New Year's Eve it really was. Spectacular fireworks and hundreds of thousands of people around the harbour or wherever you were. Don't forget, you can listen to this show via live streaming if you're not in the Liverpool area. You can listen to it in Siberia if you want via live streaming on the 2GLF website. Just Google 2GLF is probably the easiest way. And you can listen live to that. You can also listen live through our website, www.dadsontheair.net. That's dadsontheair.net, beautifully redesigned by our researcher, Greg Andreessen. He's done a wonderful job on that. Troubled here. We're having some technical difficulties with the phone trying to get out. So what we're going to do is take a look at everything that we did through 2009 and take a look at some of the highlights there. We're going to be talking with Sue Price from the Men's Rights Agency again, just to get an update on how family law is progressing in Australia. It's a very big year as the left-wing Labor government rolls back the very, very modest reforms of the previous government, so we'll take a look at that, and we'll also be taking a look at some of the highlights of the year. We've got in the studio with us Ian Purdy from inpurdy.com.
Yes, good morning, John. Good morning, listeners.
And myself, John Stapleton. Just one little news item here first up. If you are about to become a dad, there is a survey on the ABC, the Australian Broadcasting Commission, the incidentally, I suppose, the family court's favourite media outlet. They've slavishly reported the propaganda from the family law industry for many decades. But that aside, the Catalyst, the science show there, is running a nationwide survey on new dads. And if you go to abctv.net.au or just Google Catalyst again at the ABC, there is a survey, Men's Health During Partner's Pregnancy Questionnaire. The study is an online questionnaire, takes about 20 minutes, and they're asking that for you to fill it out. All your answers and personal details will be treated in the strictest confidence and will be only used for the purpose of the study. And for any questions about the study, you can feel free to contact Catalyst reporter Dr. Jonica Newby on catalyst@abc.net.au, and we might get to try and get Dr. Jonica Newby on shortly to talk about that. Now, you, Ian Purdy.
Yes, look, I'm about
vindicated.
To be vindicated at last. In this morning's Telegraph, and of course all over the media, as well, let's just go with the Telegraph. The article is headed, Smacking Helps Kids Be Happy. Let me repeat that. Smacking helps kids be happy. The article states, young children who are smacked by their parents grow up to be happier and more successful than those who have never been hit, research shows. The study found that children who were smacked before the age of six performed better at school when they were teenagers. Now, I've always said that smacking of toddlers is an essential child-raising tool. Anyway, the article goes on to state, but it was also revealed that children who were smacked after the age of six were more likely to exhibit behavioural problems, which I think is fair enough. The study by Marjorie Gunneau, Professor of Psychology at Calvin College in the US state of Michigan, found there was not enough evidence to prove that smacking harmed most children. The claims made for not spanking children fail to hold up, she said. So, look, I've been a very vocal advocate of smacking children, and I'm not talking about punching them or kicking them. I'm talking about giving them a smack on the bum, usually with a nappy, when they're toddlers, basically to set boundaries for them so that they know where the boundaries are, so they know where the safe areas are and where they are in danger. And I believe smacking is absolutely essential to set that up in a child's head. And I personally blame the fact that modern children have not been smacked on the fact that they're all walking around out in the street with knives, chopping each other up, because they don't feel safe. They feel like they have to be able to protect themselves. They feel like they need to tool up and use weapons. And I trace this back to the fact that they were not properly disciplined as children, and it actually says in the United Nations Charter for the Rights of a Child that a child has a right to be correctly disciplined, and I agree with that. And smacking, in my opinion, and I'm being vindicated by this study, is an essential tool for any caring, loving parent. There you go.
Right. Now, another news item here, the One in Three campaign. This is a campaign to highlight the fact that men as well as women are the victims of domestic violence, and takes a it's an interesting campaign because it looks immediately at that factoid, which is so widespread in the community and in the media as well, that one in three women are the victims of domestic violence. And, of course, if you look at how that factoid, that's widely reported and widely used and widely abused, you might say, figure in how that came about. And it's a very interesting history. There was an old French philosopher that said that if the majority of people believe something, it's very likely not to be true, and it's another case. One in Three campaign, How's Attitude Shift on Violence Against Males, is the title of the press release. More than twice as many people now think women are just as likely to commit domestic violence as men. Over the past 14 years, the number has risen from 9 to 22% of the population, and a further 46% now accept women also commit acts of domestic violence, although this group still believes men commit the majority of abuse. The findings come from a survey of more than 10,000 Australians commissioned by the federal government and released beginning of December, by Prime Minister Kevin Rudd to mark White Ribbon Day, which of course is the annual peak of domestic violence propaganda. The survey also found that 38% of males and 46% of females thought the level of fear experienced by domestic violence victims was the same for males and females. With the One in Three campaign spokesman Greg Andreessen said he was very pleased to see that Australian community beliefs about violence were falling into line with the research statistics on the issue. Quote, all the major recent community surveys, as well as crime, homicide, hospital and violence order statistics, reflect the fact that up to one in three victims of sexual assault and at least one in three victims of family violence and abuse are male. It's very pleasing to see that the attitudes held by Australians are finally acknowledging that family violence is a two-way street. Because you won't get those statistics out of New South Wales hospitals, where it is legislated that any woman presenting with any injury in a New South Wales or Sydney hospital is required to undergo a survey on domestic violence. Any man showing up, and of course the central hospitals in Sydney are all in the gay districts, but any man showing up, whether it be from a male or female partner, they're not questioned at all, which distorts, it's an astonishingly sexist piece of legislation and distorts the statistics totally. You've got some more there.
Oh, look, yes, another article in this morning's Telegraph. Sex findings, a bit of an anticlimax, is the headline. You can call off the search, chaps. The G-spot may not exist after all. Researchers who have studied 1,800 women found no evidence of the female erogenous zone. They believe it may be a figment of women's imaginations, encouraged by magazines and sex therapists, and responsible for making them feel sexually inadequate. Well, I wonder what else you could put in that category, eh? The G-spot is supposed to be a small area of the female body where nerve endings are concentrated. If activated by a sexual partner, it is supposed to give supreme sexual pleasure. Well, there you go, and it doesn't exist. Well, I would have thought that was the clitoris anyway. I mean, everybody knows that the clitoris has like something like 1,000 times more nerve endings than the penis, even though it is smaller in its outward manifestation. But it is actually a large organ.
I don't think we need a sex education lesson at this hour of the morning, dear boy.
Well, that's what is in the paper, and I'm just reporting.
Oh, yes, here. You're just an objective reporter.
That's
yes.
It. That's
no,
it. Thank
no
you,
no spin.
Oh, no. No spin at all.
No,
so there you go. The G-spot apparently doesn't exist. So all that searching around down there, guys, you can just stop it. There's no such thing. It's a myth.
All right. Well, on that lofty note, we'll be back in a moment. We'll be talking with Sue Price from the Men's Rights Agency. Thank you. You there? Yes.
with all these other single men, with a ring around the bar and a cigarette but in my blue. And I haven't always been a lonely man, and I haven't always lived alone. And you know I haven't always drunk this much, but hey, before you cut me down, just stop standing in my shoes, 'cause I don't have to hear one word I've missed. No, on any other day I might care what you say, but every Saturday is Father's Day. And you might call it sad, you might call me mad, but I've got one who calls me dad. And all the other blokes that live up here know how to leave a man alone. They're not a bad old bunch that live up here. Ah, but you know that it's not family and it's not home. What of a darling wife that once I had? Well, I'm pleased to say that she still talks to me. But I try not to think of what went wrong, 'cause if I say that I was right, she might say that she was right, and the only rights I care about are visitor rights. Yeah. On any other day, I might care what you say, but every Saturday is Father's Day. You might call it sad, you might call me mad, but I've got one who calls. Calls me dad. Yeah, he calls me dad. I haven't always been a single man.
We're back. Yes, indeed, we are. And on the line right now, I have Sue Price. Good morning, Sue. How are you?
Good morning. Happy New Year to everybody.
Thank you very much. It's Ian. I know you've been talking to John on the phone, and it's probably a bit strange for you to suddenly be encountering my voice. John is frantically running away, getting sets of headphones ready.
But oh, right. I thought he might have been getting a heart starter or a cup of coffee or something.
No, he's already done all that, and he's in fine form, and I believe his cans have just arrived on his head, so he might actually be able to contribute something semi-intelligent.
Right. Sue, welcome back to Dad's
morning,
on the Air.
How are you?
Good. Well, this is the first show of 2010, and we're just sort of taking a look at what's going on, really, 2009, 2010, the shifting zeitgeist.
If you thought that 2006 was a busy year with all the lobbying, or 2003, 4, 5 and 6 was busy with all the lobbying that we did of politicians, you ain't seen nothing yet, I have to tell you, about 2010. If men don't get off the proverbials and lobby their politicians to make sure that shared parenting isn't rolled back, then, I don't know what's going to happen. It's going to be really busy. There's all these reviews being conducted by the government. We haven't been privy to the results of those reviews as yet, yet we know that the one conducted by Richard Chisholm has already been sent to the government, but the government are procrastinating about whether they're going to release it or not.
Now, this review is... there's claims that this review by Richard Chisholm, a former family court judge who's always been a sort of great stalwart of the old system, isn't he? A sort of great protector of the old family law industry, you might say.
And pretty much anti-male.
Well, that's certainly the reputation. What... where do you think this will all go? It's correct, isn't it? This is already influencing judgments.
Oh, I believe so, yes. I think it is influencing judgments among the old-style judges and those who are pushing to roll back the shared parenting changes. So, you know, we have a huge fight on our hands to protect those shared parenting changes, and we must make sure that the family court... It does follow the legislation as it is currently written today, instead of wandering off into their own interpretations of how they wish it to turn out.
Well, they're often accused of that. They've long been accused of that, haven't they?
Well, feminist jurisprudence.
Essentially,
I think
yes.
So. Yes, I think they have, and unfortunately, I had great hopes for our current... Chief Justice, but I'm afraid she's been influenced unduly by the existing staff in the family court confines, or she was secretly a feminist all the way through.
So you're saying the court is as anti-father and anti-male as it's ever been?
The hierarchy seems to be at the moment, yes. I am concerned that the Federal Magistrates Court is going to be rolled back into the family court environs. Once that happens, they will be under the influence of the family court. The family court at this stage seems to take great delight in turning over decisions made by federal magistrates that may be a little bit out of the realm of feasibility for family court, such as the decision of the father who was allowed to stay at his job and the mother was told she shouldn't move back to Sydney when she wanted to separate. That was overturned by the family court that was upheld by the family court and then overturned by the High Court. So I'm giving a little bit of misinformation there.
These are taxpayer funds that are funding these cases right through to the High Court. That's correct, isn't it? No normal litigant could afford to take a family law squabble to the High Court.
Yeah, I believe that's the case.
So this is entire bureaucrat taxpayer funded. It's your money that's being used to get these judgments against.
The father in these circumstances had run out of funds. It had cost him a lot of money to go through, you know, the court system to try and ensure that he had an ongoing relationship with his child. And of course this has now failed and presumably the mother's going to go back to Sydney, or it's going to go back to trial. I'm not sure where it's gone to from here. But there are other decisions that would seem to be following through with the particular notion that shared parenting is bad for children. And there's no proof of that whatsoever, but we have a number of people arguing against shared parenting, led by Richard Chisholm does seem to be a particular proponent against shared parenting. Dr. Jennifer McIntosh also.
How did these people get themselves to head inquiries when their views are so well known?
Well, they became the favourites with the government during the process of the inquiry into the joint custody inquiry. Jennifer McIntosh came out of nowhere, I think introduced possibly by Parkinson. But she became a favourite of them because she offered them a way out, and she appeared to be in favour of shared parenting, but it turns out she doesn't think shared parenting is a good thing for youngsters under 3 years old, because she hangs on to the attachment theory, which is really a misinformed theory as far as I'm concerned, that was formulated in the 1950s, and it was based on children's need to have attachment to an adult. But the children that they investigated were children from the war years who had lost both parents. So when they did this inquiry in the 1950s, nobody actually thought of fathers as being a reliable substitute or co-partner to parent children.
Right. So it's just another case of selectively picking studies that suit their ideological agenda.
That's right.
Is that it?
And I believe it was Jennifer McIntosh was described to me as being the guru of the Relationships Australia, whom of course the listeners will realise run most of the family relationship centres. So they are following.
And also put in submissions against shared parenting in the custody inquiry. So they've immediately handed over all these relationship centres to anti-shared parenting advocates.
That's right.
It's just preposterous mess.
So this
is partly the former government's fault. We were always really critical that the reforms did not go far enough and were too easily overturned.
That's right. Failed
to take into account the appalling conduct of family law in Australia, which is just so abysmal, so fundamentally dishonest and so fundamentally corrupt, did nothing to really change any of it.
It went a little way towards changing, and certainly there have been more cases of shared parenting than not out of the changes.
Mm.
So, you know, that was a step forward. And remember, we're talking about 25 years, overturning 25 years of dogma and the procedures that have been put into place. So it wasn't a bad step forward. What we have to do now is to hang on to that step forward and push it forward again to the next step of having parents both recognised as being equally important and essential in their children's lives, even though they may not be able to spend shared parenting time with their children. That's a problem in this country. We devalue a father in his child's life because he may not be able to spend the number of hours with the child as the mother might do. But usually because of his work situation, perhaps because he's working away from home, he works longer hours, and that's the way this family decided to organise their life when they decided to have children. But he's penalised, and the child is penalised by not having an equal relationship with both parents.
And so because these people adopt, I suppose, what are seen as more traditional roles of the bloke going out to work and the woman looking after the kid, that they pay a very high price for that if they separate.
Enormously high price. They're virtually alienated out of their child's life, and yet they're still expected to pay all the bills.
Right.
There's been an article written on the internet, which is a fairly long article. It's called The Misandry Bubble. And they ask the question, why does it seem that American society is in decline, that fairness and decorum are receding, that socialism and tyranny are becoming malignant despite the majority of public being averse to such philosophies, yet the true root cause seems elusive. This writer is suggesting that the Western world has quietly become a civilization that undervalues men and overvalues women, where the state forcibly transfers resources from men to women, creating various perverse incentives for otherwise good women to conduct great evil against men and children, and where male nature is vilified but female nature is celebrated. This is unfair to both genders and is a recipe for rapid civilizational decline and displacement, the cost of which will ultimately be borne by subsequent generation of innocent women rather than men as soon as 2020. So it looks like we're heading down into an abysmal future by all accounts.
It's a really interesting article that you can find it on something called singularity2050.com, or if you register with the I've gone blank. Lindsay's
Lindsay, yeah. I can email it to Dad's on the Air, and you can put it up on your website. And it is an interesting article. It is long, but the writer has covered a lot of the issues of what's happening with our cultural situation, what's happening with our future that we're creating for our children, and the devaluation of women as women and men as men.
So where will all this go in the next decade, do you think?
Well, I think eventually there will be questions to be answered about, has feminism been good for the community? Has it been good for women? And I believe there'll be a huge debate about that. Some feminist changes have been good, obviously, but others, once we get into the gender feminism and feminist supremacy, that is where the problems occur.
It is just, when you drift from one extreme, any extreme really, from, you know, extreme male bashing to extreme female bashing, basically, isn't it?
That's right.
It's the problems you get at either end of the spectrum.
Instead of us supporting each other as we should be doing, and, we have enough troubles in the world with creating wars between the genders, but that is what some sections of the women's movement seem to be intent on doing.
Why would a Labor government, which was built on the blood, sweat and tears of working class men, launch into this vexed battle and launch a campaign? And it's such a rigged campaign. None of these inquiries have bothered to consult fathers or fathers groups or the general community at all. Why would they do this?
That's a very interesting question, but I think that goes back to the Labor Party itself, and I doubt whether the Labor Party have really represented the workers, so-called, or the families of Australia in any seriousness for many, many years, and that's part of their problem. They are totally divorced from reality of what goes on with the population. They're politicians from the union movement. The union movement has become a training ground only for politicians, and that is where most of them come from. Few of them have done a day's work in a real job in their life, and this is what we're seeing.
All right, Sue, well, we're going to wind up. Can you just give us a bit of a wrap-up about what people should be worried about at this point in time, and also what, as an individual, most people feel either battered or beaten by the whole system, or even embarrassed to be seen to be putting their hand up.
I think we need to be taking a very positive approach, and we need to be really pushing home the message that fathers are good for kids. This is what has been missing. We can talk about the war with what the women are doing and what they're not doing and the damage that they're causing, but what we need to be really emphasizing is how good dads are with their kids, how kids benefit. Look, the children in America, and I'm sure we've got similar statistics here, I think it's 80% or something of children or young men who are in jail come from fatherless families. That statistic in itself should be telling the community something. And if people don't take notice of that, we're being very foolish in our future protection of parents and the need for fathers to be included in their children's lives.
That's great. We've been talking with Sue Price from the Men's Rights Agency. You might just mention, I hate to put you on the spot on air, but we've got an album of music that Dads on the Air has done called Man Agony, which we're just getting the artwork organised to put up on the website at the moment, and that will be available for $25, including postage, very shortly.
Wonderful, so, John.
Yeah, and there's some beautiful songs in it, so maybe we can send you the material for your website as well.
Marvellous. We'll put it up there.
Great. And that website for your agency?
www.mensrights.com.au. And we do have a series of three postcards which we are sending out to people to send to their various politicians. The first one is about men who are victims of domestic violence. And it's the lead paragraph is up to 40% of domestic violence victims are men. Why do Australian governments ignore them? Then we have another one about sticks and stones may break my bones, but I never thought my mum would ever hurt me. More children are killed, abused by their mother than by their biological father. And the final one in the series is about mummy and daddy taught me to share. Now it's their turn to share their time with me. Equal parenting time works for children when parents are fair with each other. And the message particularly is children need both parents. Those postcards are available to be distributed to federal politicians. All you need to do is send a self-stamped addressed envelope to me here at Men's Rights and we'll forward the postcards to you.
Great. Yeah. That's great.
Okay.
Thank you, Sue.
Thank you very much indeed.
And we'll be speaking to you no doubt more as the year unfolds.
No doubt. Okay.
No doubt. Okay. We'll be back.
from wall to wall, lost in the horror of Golden Street Hall. Golden Street Hall, where love has to crawl. Down comes the gavel, the winner takes all. Golden Street Hall, my heart is a pole, and the conventual carnage behind the creole. It was a marble wood panels, horsehair. The symbols of conflict, dead love and despair. Institutionalized horror all day. Haunting sad hearts that can't run away. All for nothing and nothing for all. Life slipped through fingers in Golden Street Hall. A modern torture chamber disguised as a court. Processing daily and an endless onslaught. The pain and dysfunction of lies and deceit. While lawyers circle round like spaniels on heat. Nobody knows how far they can fall. Till they have been to the seventh floor. All the street hall, come first to call. Down comes the gavel, the winner takes all. Golden Street Hall, my heart is a ball. And the conventional carnage behind every door. Golden Street Hall, where love has to crawl. Down comes the gavel, the winner takes all. Golden Street Hall, my heart.
So fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child.
What do you care? It's not like you were ever there anyway.
Dads in Distress meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back. With Dad's on the air.
Are men the oppressors of women, or are women the oppressors of men? A woman wakes up in the morning in a house built by men. She starts the water to boil on a stove built by men, and sits at a chair and table put there by men, to read a newspaper written in part by women, but printed and delivered by men. She nibbles some toast made from grains grown and harvested by men. Whoops! Time to take a shower. She turns a faucet handle installed by a man, and lo and behold, out comes hot water, delivered by a vastly complicated water system built and maintained by men. She drives to work in a car built by men, on roads built by men, powered by petroleum, drilled and refined and delivered by men. She arrives at an office building built by men, walks to her desk, fires up her computer, and glances out her window at a city built by men, full of potential customers for her service business. Out of the corner of her eye, a table in the conference room that seems awkwardly out of place snags her attention. She strokes her earlobe. At that moment, the janitor scoots by in the hallway. "Bob, oh Bob, could you please move that table further into the corner? You're such a dear." She pins him with a delectable and utterly phony smile. Bob, oblivious to the cheapness of the words and falseness of the smile, thrilled to get any attention at all from such an attractive person, pitches right in, and as he lugs one corner of the heavy table across the carpet, she exhales a comfortable sigh. Her day has begun. She will spend the next 8 to 10 hours telling other people what to do. That's her understanding of work. This creature, who has no idea where things come from, how they are made, and has not the slightest knowledge about how the world works, has been put in charge of it. Because there is really nothing else of any specific value she could be doing. If she lived in a world built by women, she would be sitting in a tent, watching her breath in front of her face, stitching animal hides. But she lives in a world built almost entirely by men. And amazingly, she has not the slightest appreciation or gratitude for that fact. She never even stops to think about it. Never stops to think that if all the things men make and do were magically removed, right now she would be plodding through a muddy swamp looking for red-winged blackbird eggs. She thinks the world is made out of proper grammar and attractive clothing and polite conversation and correct opinions, instead of rivets and concrete and copper and petroleum. From the day she picked up her first teaspoon, she has been learning how to manipulate the things men provide, as if they were put in front of her by God or Mother Nature. She has no idea what men actually do. Yet, according to her and the media she consumes, men are assholes. How long do you think this is gonna last? When I think of the men, the lumberjacks and truck drivers and paper mill workers and printers and delivery men, the men who have to get up early every morning and do very hard jobs, so that Ellen Goodman and Maureen Dowd and other feminist blowhards can sit in their climate-controlled offices, shitting out editorials about what assholes men are. When I think of those women walking on the backs of all those men, I want to start bombing things. Let's bomb them all the way back to the unheated tent and the muddy swamp and see what they complain about then. Maybe they'll start writing editorials about how women should start doing real work, not just office work. Here are the facts. 19 out of 20 people who die on the job are men. 4 out of 5 suicides are men. 85% of the homeless are men. Women live 7 years longer than men. 65% of America's wealth is owned by women, says Forbes magazine. Men are not regarded as equal parents to their children. Men are drafted in time of war, and women are not. Given these facts, how could anyone with half a brain possibly believe that men are the oppressors of women? Now hear this. Men are now, and always have been, the protectors and providers for women. The protectors and providers for women.
And that was Rich Zubati. He's got a couple of websites, www.therudeguy.com, and he has written an extremely informative work called What Men Know That Women Don't. That's Rich Zubati. We interviewed him on Dads on the Air early in 2009. It was a fascinating interview, and as you can tell from that little rant, he is a very interesting character. This is Peter van der Voort.
For both father and child.
We try to adjust and happy memories are filed.
It's hard to cope with a life full of stress.
That's leaving us empty, our emotions a mess.
Despite our separation, our love will not die. With courage and hope, it will keep us together. Help us to grow.
Hey, all you children, we don't see your dad. We both need each other to share what we have. Fathers love their children as much as mothers do. We must fight this injustice.
There will come a time before we're too old.
You'll sit down together, Dad, and the truth will be told.
We'll discover the lies that have kept us apart.
No more will they try stealing what's in our hearts.
And so we will conquer betrayal and pain. Questions of why is it so? And sooner or later, the truth we will know.
Hey, all you children, we don't see your dad. We both need each other to share what we have. Fathers love their children as much as mothers do. We must fight this injustice for me and for you. Hey, all you children who don't see your dad, we both need each other to share what we have. Fathers love their children as much as mothers do. We must fight this injustice for me.
I'm doing the best I can, kids.
Love you, miss you, Dad.
Just remember, there's always two sides to every story.
Can we meet
you, Dad? Dad's in distress, meeting your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437, or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
Hello, this is Amfortas, and the title of my podcast today is Give a Dog a Bad Name. and expect to get bitten. I dedicate this podcast to my estranged daughter, for whom I grieve, and my beloved son, in whom I am well pleased. Feminism has long drawn attention to and fought against stereotypical and sexist portrayals of women in mass media. But new research shows that media portrayals of gender have largely executed an about-face in the past decade or so. There is a deliberate and unprovoked gender war. In the main target of discrimination is not women, according to the research, it is men. In this podcast, I will look at the evidence. It is comprehensive. And in part two, the unintended effects, if indeed they are unintended. The feminists' so-called gender studies have claimed that mass media portrayals and images are key influences that both reflect and shape society's views of women and women's self-identity. They do not consider men. As well as attacking so-called sexist media portrayals, such as Page Three Girls and Girly magazines, which incidentally feature young, empowered women taking their clothes off without a skerrick of duress and doing what they want to for copious amounts of money. Feminists have challenged objectification, marginalization, trivialization, and other negative portrayals of women in movies, advertising, TV drama, and other media content. Although it is increasingly hard to find any such representations not driven by women themselves, their argument that such portrayals are damaging have won eager support from legislators and from most media professionals, including filmmakers, advertising producers, and editors. After all, it is women who are the primary consumers of media's fruits. Until recently, gender theorists and media researchers have argued and lied or simply assumed that media representations of men are predominantly positive. Men have allegedly been shown in mass media as powerful, dominant, heroic, successful, respected, independent, they say, and in other positive ways conducive to men and boys maintaining a healthy self-identity and self-esteem. All things that feminists do not like one bit. But hey, Errol Flynn died decades ago. Marlborough Man too. The mendacious feminist view has come under challenge over the past few years. John Bennion, a Welsh academic, explained how masculinity was portrayed in the British quality press, including The Times, The Guardian and The Sunday Times, and more, over a three-year period from 1999 to 2001. He didn't look deeply at the more crass tabloid press where matters are considerably worse. Susan Faludi's 2000 bestseller Stiffed, The Betrayal of Modern Man, also finds and exposes the myths and lies and rings alarm bells about the false image of men in our society. Bennion concluded in his 2002 book Masculinities and Culture, that men and masculinity were overwhelmingly presented negatively and as something dangerous to be contained, attacked, denigrated or ridiculed. In Australia, a broader and more extensive content analysis of mass media portrayals of men and male identity was undertaken in 2005 at the University of Western Australia by Dr. Jim McNamara. It focused on news, features, current affairs, talk shows and lifestyle media, and found that men are widely demonized, marginalized, trivialized and objectified in non-fiction media content that allegedly presents facts, reality and truth. Examine the quality and scope of the evidence. The study involved collection of all editorial content, no cherry-picking, referring to or portraying men from 650 newspaper editions, that's 450 broadsheets and 200 tabloids, 130 magazines, 125 news bulletins, 147 TV current affairs programmes, 125 talk show episodes, and 108 TV lifestyle programme episodes. They were from the 20 highest circulating and rating newspapers, magazines and TV programmes over a complete six-month period. Media articles were examined using in-depth quantitative and qualitative content analysis methodology. This comprehensive and exhaustive research found in volume that fully 69% of mass media reporting and commentary on men was unfavourable, compared to just 12% favourable and 19% neutral. Men were predominantly reported or portrayed in mass media as villains, aggressors, perverts and philanderers, with more than 75% of all mass media representations of men and male identities showing men in one of these four ways. More than 80% of media mentions of men in total were negative, compared with 18.4% of mentions which showed men in a slightly positive role. The overwhelmingly negative reporting of and portrayals of men in mass media news, current affairs, talk shows and lifestyle media was mainly in relation to violence and aggression. Violent crime, including murder, assault, armed robberies and attacks such as bashings, accounted for almost 40% of all media reporting of male violence and aggression, followed by sexual abuse, 20.5%, general crime, 18.6%, and domestic violence, 7.3%. Disregarded is the fact that crime is a feature of a tiny minority in our society, and the vast majority of men are law-abiding, family-supporting, self-sacrificing chaps going about their lawful occasions. Men who are increasingly dismayed at the ease and frequency of which women denigrate them. Other topics of media coverage of men were fatherhood and family, male sexuality, work and career, and men's social behaviour. In all of these categories, men were predominantly reported and portrayed negatively. Fully one-third of all media discussion of male sexuality examined in the study was in relation to pedophilia, which demonstrates the appalling distortion inherent in debate on men, given that an infinitesimal proportion of men are pedophiles. Fatherhood, a prominent also-ran subject, was discussed in 361 media articles and features during the period of the study. Some media coverage positively discussed men as fathers, pointing to increasing recognition of the importance of fathers in children's lives. However, along with the recognition of the importance of fathers and the depth of many men's emotional connection with their children, discussion contained an almost equal number of criticisms of men as deadbeat dads, commitment phobic, and as perpetrators of domestic violence and sexual abuse within the families. That sexual abuse is far less common in a family with a biological father in it than without, in fact statistically negligible, is totally ignored or suppressed. Men are exclusively portrayed as the perpetrators of domestic violence and child abuse, despite evidence of violence and abuse committed by women. The National Family Violence Survey in the US, for instance, found women just as likely to commit violence against men as men are against women. And a US National Incidence of Child Abuse and Neglect report in 2000 that found that where maltreatment of children led to death, 78% of the perpetrators were female. Where is that ever reported in our media? What an image of men to present to the target audience of the media, the primary consumer, women. They know that women want to see men as bad, it seems, in order to justify buying stuff from the media's sponsors. The media's deliberate, contrived image of men is wrong, very wrong, factually and morally. The Australian Advertising Standards Bureau reported in 2005 that TV commercials drew a record and increasing number of complaints from men during 2004, while those from women are decreasing. The Australian federal government's $73 million advertising campaign against domestic violence, which targeted only men as perpetrators of DV and only women as victims, was labelled propaganda against men, with many men criticising its negative and blatantly false stereotypical portrayals, as reported in The Age of January 3, 2005. One notable Australian commentator described it as the worst piece of deliberate government black propaganda against a biologically distinguishable group ever seen outside of Nazi Germany. Doris Lessing, the famous British early feminist author, said at the Edinburgh Book Festival in August 2001, "I find myself increasingly shocked at the unthinking and automatic rubbishing of men, which is now so part of our culture that it is hardly even noticed." She went on to point out, "The most stupid, ill-educated and nasty woman can rubbish the nicest, kindest and most intelligent man, and no one protests." Her audience was stunned. One could add that intelligent, educated TV presenter and news editor women are as bad as their crude, nasty sisters, seeking every opportunity to create a false image to suit their anti-male agenda. Indeed, their university education in women's studies lies at the root of their systematic and public misandry. Stupid is also an increasing thematic portrayal of men, especially in television adverts, which the Australian study did not cover. Men are routinely portrayed as fools, idle, good for nothing and inept, usually a second fiddle to their so much smarter and more decisive female partners. In adverts, the suave, empowered, successful executive woman is married to a stupid boy man who cannot open a can of beans and whose children are more capable at doing year four homework than he is. Canadian authors Paul Nathanson and Catherine Young, in a controversial 2001 book, Spreading Misandry, The Teaching of Contempt for Men in Popular Culture, reported widespread examples of laughing at men, looking down on men, blaming men, dehumanizing men and demonizing men in modern mass media. They concluded, "The worldview of our society has become increasingly both gynocentric, focused on the needs and problems of women, and misandric, focused on the evils and inadequacies of men." This seems pervasive in too many TV dramas. It is clear such TV shows seem to be preaching a message of defer to the woman as the only way of impressing her or stopping her being violent, and failure to do so will result in a smack to his face. Violence towards men, physical and verbal, direct and indirect, is treated as comedy or deserved. Whatever happened to "there is no excuse to violence"? Doris Lessing said, "Men seem to be so cowed that they can't fight back, and it's time they did." Now, how does one expect men to do this when there is so much legislation that forces them to keep their opinions and protests to themselves, and so much misandric vilification in all arms of our media-driven culture, the media that just won't give men a voice? With the rapid rise of female and feminist influence, seemingly devoid of the famed and hubristically claimed empathy and compassion, our media institutions are dominated by subtle verbal thugs. How do you think it affects justice in the family courts, where an industry of rent-seeking hangers-on, suffused with false and awful images of men, pass judgment? men are less cowed than chained to a post in the backyard like a dog. In part two, I will examine the effects of this chaining up. I will show how women have lost a valuable resource, thrown it away. The care and concern of even the nicest, kindest and most intelligent men that Lessing refers to. And worse, for women. Mistreated dogs bite. My thanks to Christian J for his production skills and assistance in bringing this podcast to you. Ask who the Grail serves. Now, go to part two.
That was the psychologist Dan Fortas that we had on earlier in 2009. If you want to see or listen to the full, he did a whole number of them, about a dozen different broadcasts, and we put them all together in shows earlier in 2009. You can look them up in the archive section at www.dadsontheair.net. That's dadsontheair.net. Please don't confuse it with our old site, the .com site, which is long defunct. That's dadsontheair.net. And you've got another... Oh, no, we're going to a quick song and then we'll be back.
Yes, indeed. Now, an article appeared in The Age on the 2nd of January, written by Julie Medew under the heading, What Do Children Want? Time, Not Toys. So she asks the question and then she answers it. I'll just read from the article. Julie Medew writes, while most Australian children continue to throw their Christmas presents around this weekend, breaking many along the way, one expert has a word of advice for the parents. Forget about showering them with gifts. Do not overschedule their time and get down on their level to engage with them as much as you can. It may seem obvious, but Professor Frank, oh, this is a hard one, Abeklade, sorry, Professor Frank, if I've mispronounced your name, says that some parents may not understand how sensitive their children's brains are to their environment. The founding director of the Centre for Community Child Health at the Royal Children's Hospital says that after good nutrition, immunisation and protection from injury, children need strong relationships with their carers more than anything else to grow into healthy adults. He says, parents need to understand that what children crave is not fancy toys or to watch television or DVDs. What they crave is their parents' love and attention. It doesn't have to cost money. Sit them on your knee, read a book together, walk down to the park, and treat it like a nature study lesson. It's about spending quality time. The rewards of such interaction can be immense, the professor has said. He says that while a child's genetic makeup is the hardware of their brain, their environment is the software. In the early years of a child's life, their environment literally sculpts their brain, he says. Any environment where children and families are stressed, for example, where there is child abuse, sexual abuse, mental health problems in parents, family violence, those sorts of things, cortisol, a hormone that helps control stress levels, go up in children's brains, and persistent cortisol levels interfere with brain development. Such disruption can lead to developmental delays, language problems, learning difficulties, or conditions such as attention hyperactivity disorder. So that's all pretty sensible stuff. What do you think, John?
Very, 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 very sensible indeed.
Yes, one very too many there, but yeah. And you've got one over there, I believe, as well, out of Canada recently, something a bit positive.
It is so true, though, isn't it? You know, all the money that people pour into these things, and, you know, all you notice is spending a small fortune on kids' toys, and if you give them a couple of empty boxes, they're just as happy.
Yeah, they spend more time playing with the packaging than they do with a lot of the toys.
Oh, no, it's absolutely classic. This is a story from Barbara Kay, The End of the Gender Wars, it's titled, which is perhaps a bit of a bold prediction, although it reflects a book from the 1980s, I think, called The End of the Gender Wars in Britain, which also caused quite a furor. Anyway, Barbara Kay writes, this is just published in the National Post, and you can find it on nationalpost.com. Just Google Barbara Kay, K-A-Y. Very interesting writer. She says, and this is a big thing in Canada, this Montreal massacre, where a number of women died, and something odd occurred in the 2 days following the 20th anniversary of the Montreal massacre earlier this month. She's talking about December. Commentaries by both Margaret Went of the Globe and Mail and Jonathan Kay of the Post were sharply critical of the emotive and irrational linkage of the massacre with the phenomenon of domestic violence against women. Neither pundit is known to be anti-feminist in gender in general, but both columns recommended we desacralise the polytechnic killings, accepting them for the freak tragedy they were, and stop guilt-tripping all men for Mark Lepine's unique paranoid fixations. Ranting about the unwholesome social ends to which the massacre has been put used to be my lonely job every December the 6th. Finding myself in such good company was a happy surprise and, I think, an iconoclastic cultural moment. Let us recognise that female victimhood is not intrinsically more tragic than male victimhood, these columns seem to say. Commonsensical Canadians are losing patience with the angry, blame-all-male school of feminism. It's no accident that the feminist Toronto Women's Bookstore, for years a busting cynosure of the cultural zeitgeist, is in danger of closing down, or that once overflowing women's studies courses are emptying out, morphing into gender studies to attract more students. A trap, really. Gender studies courses are also gynocentric, offering a more subtle version of heterosexual male bashing than women's studies. Rob Kennedy, an assistant professor in the sociology department of York University with speciality in the men's rights movement, was unique amongst sociologues in teaching a course in the 1990s about men and their particular tribulations and needs. In a telephone interview, he recalled his surprise when more young women signed up than men. We've also had him on, Dad's on the Air, and fascinating it was. That, of course, was shut down. Women are far more interested in learning about men and masculinity than men are, he said, and yes, he was
predictably enough, I suppose, was squashed by women at the university who couldn't bear the idea that there might be a men's studies course as well as a women's studies course. Because the numbers in...
Ridiculous. Oh, they want equality, and you know,
yeah,
ridiculous.
But won't have a bar of it, because the numbers in universities are so skewed to the distaff in a current obligatory sociology course. His own tutorial is comprised of 25 women and 2 men. Kennedy predicts sociology departments will have to open up positive masculinity courses to satisfy the burgeoning curiosity of women about what makes men tick. Kennedy is convinced, as I am, this is Barbara Kay, that we are exiting the gender wars. Feminism is increasingly out of fashion, and recent years have seen a crumbling of the feminist foundation. Well, that really old-fashioned male-bashing feminism is certainly out of date and out of fashion, but, you know, most young women and, you know, as fathers too, we all want our young daughters to be successful and have successful careers and...
And successful relationships with men.
And just so our grandchildren can be happy and successful.
Can be brought up in stable homes.
And, you know, with changing roles and everything, you know, most women do expect to have a good education and good careers these days, and it's all for the better. I mean, we all benefit from that. Culturally sanctioned misandry, the hatred of men, says Barbara Kay, is beginning to cause discomfort. Women today want equality without stridency, a return to feminism's first principles. And positive acknowledgement of masculinity began with a public honour paid to courageous fallen firefighters of 9/11. For Canadians, it is more linked to public mourning around the deaths of soldiers in Afghanistan. And something similar is happening in Australia. The deaths of so many young men in Afghanistan is really starting to make people think about why we're sending these really lovely young blokes, real decent young blokes, to their death.
In the desert. In a foreign land over something that really doesn't concern Australia, you know, really. Anyway, I've got another one here. We've got time for another. This is just to show the hypocrisy of these so-called feminists. Domestic violence crusader Mary J. Blige, Slug's husband. You know Mary J. Blige. I'm actually going to play a track from her.
The story's great.
Yeah, Mary J. Blige punched husband Kendu Isaacs in the face at her record release party at Club M2 Tuesday night. The singer slugged Isaacs, drawing blood after she thought he was flirting with a waitress. She turned to him and was screaming, "You're not going to ruin my night," our witness says. They got up at each other's faces before someone tried to separate them, at which point she shoved the guy aside, pulled back, and popped Isaacs in the face. The source said Blige, Isaacs, and their entourage were whisked through a door to the attached Club Pink, which was closed. One witness relates she was yelling at him, "What are you going to do? Chris Brown me?" 4 of her bodyguards and 2 of the clubs kept them apart. Isaacs was kicked out. Blige went to the bathroom.
The bloke got kicked out after being whacked in the face.
Yeah, and she went to the bathroom to fix her hair and makeup, but soon fled, creating an uncomfortable scene for Beyonce and the rest of the upper list of people who were at the party. But just to add extra to this,
the guest of honour disappeared.
Yeah, but Mary J. Blige's organisation recently teamed up with the Gucci creative director Frida Gianni and several New York-based organisations to fund the opening of the Mary J. Blige Centre for Women, based in Yonkers. She tells CNN all age ranges will be able to come to the centre. Women from all walks of life, not just women from poverty-stricken areas, whatever it is, they'll be able to come here. They are going to be psychologists there, doctors there, daycare centres here. Anything you need will be here. The Grammy Award winner says she is delighted to use her fame for a good cause. That's why I think celebrities were given this job. We're not given this job to just hold on to this stuff and die with it. We're given this job to be able to touch somebody and say, "Me too. Hey," and then she slugged her husband. You know, if that's not domestic violence, Mary J. Blige, whew, you got me, baby. So here she is, Mary J. Blige, and you two singing One Love.
Is it getting better? Or do you feel the same? Will it make
or leave a bad taste in your mouth. You act like you never had love, and you want me to go without. Well, it's too late tonight to drag the past out into the light. We're one, but we're not the same. We get to carry each other, carry each other.
So fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child.
What do you care? It's not like you were ever there anyway.
Dad's in distress. Meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dad's in distress. 1-300-853-437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back.
Good old Mary Jo Blige. She's got a beautiful voice, that girl, and I believe she's got a pretty good right hook as well.
Certainly sounds like it. Woo! We were just going to reiterate there's a postcard campaign run by the Men's Rights Agency, which it's got a rather fearsome name, hasn't it, the Men's Rights Agency? It sounds a bit Ku Klux Klanny or something, but in fact it's despite its somewhat fearsome and unfashionable name, has done some amazing work. They're the ones that deal with the blokes at 4 a.m. in the morning when they're threatening to neck themselves, and they're the ones that deal with the really difficult cases. They get no government funding whatsoever, and a couple of pensioners, Sue and Reg Price, set that up when they noticed they used to own a factory, and they noticed that a lot of the blokes in the factory were suffering really severely due to separation and the operations of the Child Support Agency and so on, which turned people's lives to absolute mud. Absolute mud. That's a classic example, that one recently, where there's a bloke overseas, wants to come back to see his kids,
If he comes back, he won't be able to leave the country because of a disputed debt with the child support agencies. Therefore, he's stuck overseas, unable to see his children. Thank you, politicians. Thank you, child support agency.
So we've got to get behind this campaign. So people need to contact the Men's Rights Agency and Sue Price and get these postcards and send them to your politicians. This is important. This is in the trenches stuff. This is basically the bread and butter of Dad's on the Air. This is to defend the paltry changes brought in by the Howard government that gave us a sliver of some hope of being able to share more time with our children. Shared parenting is at risk from the Rudd government. Guys, women, everybody out there, get onto this one. We need everybody. Put your names behind it. If you don't want to send the cards yourself, just make a donation and they will send them for you. This is a very important campaign. We've got to get behind it.
And the postcards, one says, men are victims of domestic violence too, and they offer a number of statistics. So this is on the postcard. It's got a picture of a black eye. In Queensland, 39% of domestic violence orders are issued to protect men. That's from the Queensland Department of Communities figure. In New South Wales, 28.9% of domestic assault victims are men, and it's believed to be actually much higher. It's just that the figures are distorted partly because men are very reluctant to report, and also none of the hospitals or other agencies take any effort to get the statistics off men. In South Australia, 32.3% of victims who reported domestic violence by a current or ex-partner were male. That's from the South Australian Interpersonal Violence and Abuse Survey. And nationally, about 29.8% of victims of current partner violence since the age of 15 were found to be male. That's from the Australian Bureau of Statistics Personal Safety Report. Now, the figures are actually believed to be much higher, but there you go. Even from the official statistics, you can see that both men and women are the victims of domestic violence and deserve to be treated with equal dignity and equal respect.
Absolutely. Okay, now, we also did a program last year on the Iron John movement, and we played excerpts by American author Robert Bly commenting on the Iron John story. It's a fairy tale. And he does a commentary on it, and we did a whole program because there's men's groups that are forming around the place based on this commentary. So we're going to today, the show's just about over. We're going to end today. I'm just going to let Robert Bly, we're just going to turn him on and let him speak about Iron John. And here he is.
We can all add further details of the decline from warrior to soldier to murderer, but it's important to notice the result. The disciplined warrior, made irrelevant by mechanized war, disdained and abandoned by the high-tech culture, is fading in American men. And the fading of the warrior contributes to the collapse of civilized society. A man who cannot defend his own space cannot defend women or children. The poisoned warriors, called drug lords, prey primarily for recruits on kingless, warriorless boys. If a culture does not deal with the warrior energy, take it in consciously, discipline it, honor it, it will turn up outside in the form of street gangs, wife beating, brutality to children, and aimless murder. And it all moves so swiftly. The massive butcheries of 1915 finish off the disciplined or outward warrior, and then within 30 years, the warrior's inside Western men begin to weaken. The double weakening makes us realize how connected the outer and the inner world are, how serious the events of history are. Warriorhood is associated with the god Mars, and Mars with iron. Men now experience a shortage of iron. Men now do not know how to retrieve and revive their inner warriors. Oftentimes, that goes back to early childhood. A boy at 5, for example, may put one hand on his mother's heart and the other on the earth and conduct her pain down to the ground. Or he may conduct his father's rage to the ground. Many of us lived as copper conductors of intense emotions of our parents. We lived as copper conductors, not as boys. Such a man will then look, when adult, for a woman whose pain he can continue to conduct to the earth. So we can say that men now have too much copper and not enough iron. This is another way to refer to the shortage of the interior warrior. So it was Iron John's purpose in the last warrior section to help the boy develop more iron. It's the job of the older men to do the work of initiation. We know that our society produces a plentiful supply of boys, but seems to produce fewer and fewer men. Some contemporary cultures, the New Guinea tribes would be examples, who are warrior cultures, force the boys to be men through various cunning, heated, imaginative, reckless austerities and teachings that may happen too quickly to produce a solid man. We come in at the opposite end of the spectrum in that we have no ideas at all on how to produce men, and we let it all happen unconsciously while we look away to Wall Street and hope for the best. Michael Ventura, in a magnificent essay called The Age of Endarkenment, published recently in the Whole Earth Review, speaks of adolescent wildness and its challenge to our lack of ideas. Their music, their fashions, their words, their codes, he says, announce that the initiatory moment has come. Those extravagances are a request for a response, Ventura remarks. Tribal people everywhere greeted the onset of puberty, especially in males, with elaborate and excruciating initiations, a practice that plainly wouldn't have been necessary unless their young men were as extreme as ours. The tribal adults didn't run from this moment in their children as we do. They celebrated it. They would assault their adolescents with quite literally holy terror. Rituals that had been kept secret from the young until that moment. Rituals that focused upon the young all the light and darkness of their tribe's collective psyche, all its sense of mystery, all its questions, and all the stories told to both harbor and answer those questions. The crucial word here is focus. The adult had something to teach. Stories, skills, magic, dances, visions, rituals. In fact, if these things were not learned well and completely, the tribe could not survive. Tribal culture satisfied the craving while supplying the need, and we call that initiation. This practice was so effective that usually by the age of 15, a tribal youth was able to take his or her place as a fully responsible adult. Ventura notices that for about 40 years, the young in our culture have generated forms, music, fashions, behaviors, quote, that prolong the initiatory moment, as though hoping to be somehow initiated by chance somewhere along the way, unquote. It doesn't happen. Mick Jagger gets middle-aged, and still the adults offer no response to the opening. There are many sorts of initiation, many models, and many sequences of rituals and teachings. We have to recognize that all sequences of initiatory stages are linear, that we know of, and initiation itself resembles a sphere. So, with that warning, we could look now at a linear view of male initiation, which I'll lay out in five stages. The first stage would be bonding with the mother and separation from the mother. We do the first stage moderately well, and the second not well at all, particularly in the suburbs and the ghettos. Second stage, bonding with the father and separation from the father. We often postpone the father bonding until we're 50 or so, and then separation still happens.
Because we care, we ask over questions that others don't dare. We're dads on the air. We're dads on the air.